It's time to head out on the front porch on KFRM. Grab your favorite drink, sit back, relax, and enjoy the conversation on the front porch.
Hi, this is Kyle Bauer with On the Front Porch. My guest today is Steve Hewitt. He's CEO of the Kansas Turnpike Authority. We're going to talk all about the Kansas Turnpike today, its history, and some of the changes that are coming down the pike, no pun intended. And Steve, how does one get to be the CEO of the Kansas Turnpike Authority? Is there a college major for such a thing?
Well, that's a great story. I don't know. Well, I'm not sure I am a great story, but I think it's I'd like to think that it's a fun story because it is unique to how I got here. I'm a Kansas kid, and yeah, there's not probably a college student thinking they're going to be running the turnpike, but it's you know, as just a kid, I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I grew up out in western Kansas, actually Pratt and Pratt Greensburg area, because I got family in both locations. And I went to community college. I played a little tennis, and I still just didn't know what I wanted to do in life. And one thing I did enjoy, I enjoyed communications, I enjoyed politics, and those kind of things. And it's really unique because I'm talking to you because I love sports. I'm a huge sports nut. And so I thought I might go to Parks and Rec. I kept working the summers at the Parks and Rec, office and on the ball fields and doing basketball and all the things. And so I thought I might do that. But I ended up going to Fort Hays State and just kind of ended up with a communications degree and thought that I'm good at that. I can talk. I like to talk to people, public speaking. You know, I think it could take me a lot of different ways. And you know, you're looking for that job. I did get into Parks and Rec. I started back in my hometown, Parks and Rec. Did that for a little bit. Bounced around to Kansas City and back to Oklahoma. And then I kept working with city managers. And I realized I think I can do that job. I think I could be the boss. And I'm careful what you ask for sometimes, but you know, I thought I could do it. So I took a shot at a city manager job. And ironically, growing up in the Pratt Greensburg area, my dad lived in Greensburg, and he said, "Hey, our city administrator here in Greensburg, small town, you know, left. I know you're interested in getting into that." And I said, "Yeah, I am." And it was either going to go to a small town, or I was going to have to go to a bigger city and be an assistant. But I thought, you know what? Let's take a shot at it. So I take my family. We go leave from Oklahoma. Glad to get back to Kansas. We go to Greensburg. I was there 1 year as city administrator, and then the tornado hit '07. So I was the city administrator in Greensburg during the tornado. So I during that time, you met so many people. I stayed for 5 years for the rebuild. We did all the rebuilding, all the infrastructure, I mean, from A to Z. Learned a lot about infrastructure, learned a lot about, you know, just the understanding of politics and funding and all the things. And that was a huge learning curve. And then I was recruited back to a bigger city, back in Oklahoma, Clinton, Oklahoma. I was kind of tired. I was wore out from Greensburg, the tornado stuff. So I went to Oklahoma, was city manager. That wasn't as fun. Going back to Oklahoma, where our family's here in Kansas, did that for about 3 years. Actually dealt with a major water issue there, learned a lot more again. But the connections I made in Greensburg, in infrastructure, engineering, I made a lot of friends, colleagues. Then the Secretary of Transportation at the time reached out to me, and Mike King, and he said the board here at the Kansas Turnpike we're looking for somebody to take over. The guy's retiring that's here, and so we know what you've done, and we'd love to bring you back to Kansas. And I was like, you know, my wife, we were both like, Kansas. That'd be great. And as well as you're looking for that one job you can stick around and stay and retire. I think we've bounced around a few jobs, moving up the ladder. And so, wow. And so, and you get in. And so, and so it's a lot like running a city. We do a lot of projects. We maintain our day-to-day. We're a public entity. But, you know, it's just really fell into my lap. So a long story, but it's not something I really planned. It's just how it, I guess, just, you know, evolved. But I couldn't be more happy. I mean, so blessed. I think it's one of the best public jobs in the state of Kansas. So I get to help so many more people. It's an established, strong agency, and so I'm really happy with that. But that's my journey, how you become a CEO of the Kansas Turnpike.
Well, that's fascinating. But your bosses then are a 5-member board?
Yeah, so the board, you know, we, and I love to tell this right off the bat. People think, oh my gosh, you know, you got tolls and tax dollars. Well, I want to make sure everybody understands we don't take any tax dollars. I don't take any state dollars. I don't take any federal tax dollars. We live and die by the tolls and revenue we generate. We were created by the legislature back in the 50s. They put a board together. It used to be a 7-member board and changed back in the 80s to a 5-member board. And that 5-member board is the Transportation House Chairman, the Transportation Senate Chairman, the Secretary of Transportation, and then 2 at-large members that are appointed by the governor. And so that 5-member board is the board of directors. They hire me. I deal with the day-to-day, but that board oversees everything. And so they have, and we have the ability to bond projects, maintain the roadway in any way it needs to be maintained, and with projects and different things, budgets. And so it's again, like, operates a lot like a little city within the state as a transportation system.
If you were in the 50s, then you probably predated the interstate highway system.
We did. So it's a unique story. You know, the legislature in 53 passed the bill to allow the turnpike to be created. You know, it's actually a project pushed really hard by the Kansas Chamber. The Kansas Chamber wanted to make sure that our 3 largest cities, Wichita, Topeka, Kansas City, were connected. And obviously then eventually be able to connect with a really quality road down south Oklahoma City, continue on into the St. Louis, Missouri area, just making sure that there was a really quality road so that, you know, it was good for economics, and it was really a great foresight by folks in the 50s to make sure you're looking forward in how you're moving transportation and people and goods in Kansas. But yes, prior to the interstate system, so interstate actually came after, and then we were eventually designated an interstate system. But the chamber took that on, and they did not want it to be a burden on taxpayers. That's why they created the Turnpike Authority. So then the authority then has the ability to go out and get bonds. We bonded the project. I say we. I was obviously there at the time, but the authority bonded the project to build it, and had to live and die by those tolls to pay for those bonds and pay for the day-to-day maintenance and everything. And so it's a really unique story. We're self-sustaining. We don't, you know, we don't need any additional dollars, and we've done that since the 50s, and we'll continue that on I think forever, and so that we make sure we are not a burden on the state. But I think it's a great project. I think Kansans were trying to make sure they were putting infrastructure in place to make sure they could connect with other states. They were forgotten. Now, obviously, the interstate system, you know, that came afterwards. So then I-70 was eventually built, and then 135 and all the other additional connections. But it's really a unique story that Kansas kind of had the foresight to get ahead of that because they didn't want to be behind everybody else.
Well, the model of using a turnpike or a toll road obviously wasn't new in Kansas. There was probably several across the United States, but I remember in my history classes that there was toll roads clear back in colonial times.
Hey, there's always been toll roads. I mean, there's toll roads to get across a river, toll bridges, small toll roads. Yes, and back east, obviously, in eastern part of the country, toll roads have really been established early on. So Kansas is one of the earlier established toll roads, but there's actually small toll roads, prior to that. What's unique, today we have KDOT, but you didn't have KDOT back in the 50s. You had the State Highway Commission. That State Highway Commission, was put together to kind of help separate from us the authority, but it was all part of the, hey, we got to be working towards a better transportation connection, but how do we fund it? And I think it's unique that, it's worked. It's not something that's, we're not reinventing the wheel here. It's been established in other places for a long time. It can work. Always risk, it's early on. They didn't have a lot of money, didn't have a lot of cars, so you didn't have a lot of revenue. So really had to work to get by and be really lean in how they did things until the road was established. And just some fun facts, I mean, we're 236 miles from Kansas City all the way to the Oklahoma border. We have six different service areas. So we've got different, restaurants and fuel stations for you to use if needed. It's 1,000 lane miles, obviously, with so we have some six lane in the I-70 corridor, and then we're four lane south of Topeka. We have 350 bridges that we maintain on the Kansas Turnpike. I have nine different maintenance facilities, so I kind of keep my maintenance facilities about 30-35 miles apart so they can work on that section of roadway to keep it really sharp and really nice. So we really invest and I think we do a nice job of making sure we have a safe, reliable, really good, fiscally smart road here that we have, and we have some of the lowest tolls in the country, and I think that's always good for Kansas. Hey, listen, we got a great system, and we keep it affordable, and we know you have a choice. You don't have to drive the Kansas Turnpike. It's going to cost you a little bit, but we want to make sure it's affordable, and you got a great system, so you get something for that premium.
That is Steve Hewitt. He's CEO of the Kansas Turnpike Authority and native of Pratt, Kansas. When we come back, we're going to talk about the evolution of the Turnpike, how it was built and how it's being maintained today, and the future of the Turnpike. So join us after the break for more on the Front Porch. Welcome back to On the Front Porch. We're talking today with Steve Hewitt. He's CEO of the Kansas Turnpike Authority. We're talking the history of the Turnpike and the future. Steve, I was born in 58, and as I recall, the Turnpike was built prior to my birth. So all my life, I remember the Turnpike. And in its day, it was truly way above its time because it predated the interstate highway system. But it had to have some controversy when it was proposed and determined it was going to be built, because it was all built with private money.
Yeah, so it's always a challenge when you take on a big project like that. I mean, you're talking 236 miles, and when you talk about the fact that, what infrastructure costs, how are you going to fund that and pay that? And I mentioned earlier that, this effort, the Kansas Chamber, it took on a big push to help make sure that this thing could happen, and you had to have some backing. But yeah, you're absolutely right, because what's the biggest thing? I think people understand transportation and a new road is probably something that Kansas needs, but I don't necessarily want it in my backyard. I don't necessarily want it, and you're taking through my land. And so, you're talking, 236 miles, and you're talking clear through the state. It's not going to be easy to really talk everybody into potentially, getting their land. And so now, and a unique, so 1953, they passed legislation to begin the process. We opened the doors in October of 1956. You're talking 22 months of construction and you know, buying right away and getting design and that is unheard of today, by the way. I mean, it would take us 22 months to probably, you know, get permitting, you know, let alone with the design right away, making the deals. So they went out real quick. So they took a team, went out, they kind of divided and conquered. Now here's the thing, it's I'm sure the stories have evolved over the years, and so, you know, and what is really the true story. I think it's fun, the history, but yeah, it's never easy to go through such a large project and beg these folks and you don't have to beg. I mean, you can take it forcefully. I think that's what, nobody wants to do that. So how do you make deals with these folks that we can go through your land? So the rumor is, how was the route even decided? Well, you know, at a restaurant and, you know, over maybe some drinks and some discussion, they pull out a napkin and they start mapping out, hey, this is the route we want to go. And so the rumor is the route was on the back of a napkin. Now, is that true or not? Well, who really knows? Well, I don't have the actual, you know, verification of that, but it's a great story, I think. And so wouldn't surprise me. I think it could, because of how fast they went, they needed a, hey, this is the route we need to get to. And I think understanding some of these cities we need to be close to, and we make sure we're close to Lawrence, make sure, you know, by El Dorado, let's go through Emporia. I think those kind of things had to be designed and looked at. It would make sense. Obviously, you got to find a route that gets through the Flint Hills and what's going to be the easiest route. And I think if anybody's driven the Turnpike, you know, it's got lots of curves and moves and different things. You know, why'd they do it like that? Because probably today those wouldn't be in design. We wouldn't have so many big, deep curves and this and that. It was like, hey, I think they just got it done. They were just innovative, fast, and found a way to get the job done. So they, in 22 months, as I mentioned, and then when you talk about what it cost, holy smokes. I mean, you know, for example, we did a Kansas River Bridge back in, I think wrapped it up in 2013, 2014, something like that. That bridge alone, up by Lawrence, cost more than the entire Turnpike cost to build back in the 50s. So the cost around $105 million, you know, to get built. And then in today's terms, it's like, you know, that's like billions of dollars. I mean, for us to do 236 miles of interstate would be in the billions. It's an unbelievable amount of money to do what they did. But they found a way to get it done. They began to work directly out with, you know, landowners quickly. Hey, we want, and started making deals really quick. Hey, and so it was funny, unique. So you'll see a lot of, when I say 350 bridges, because you might see we're driving over a bridge, like, was that really a bridge? Since a bridge can be determined in a lot of different ways, but it can be actually like a cattle passing, you know, because for livestock, because we're splitting farmers' land. So we made agreements, a bunch of land agreements, to allow farmers to still connect their property. So listen, I'm a rancher. I need to get over there. So the Turnpike built that bridge over that area so they could, you know, deal with drainage, but also deal with allowing that farmer and that rancher to be able to get equipment and livestock through. And most, they made a lot of good deals and things went quickly. There was a few of those, you know, had to go to court, had to fight it out a little bit, but, you know, still in 22 months to get all the right away, get the design, start construction, and they just kept moving along. You know, we couldn't do it today like that. I wish we could. I mean, I just, you know, they just cut the nonsense out, found a way to do it, and yeah, it came with some headaches, and every now and then, you know, and I'll be very candid, you know, when we've had to go back and expand the right of way or do some drainage work and we got to deal with a landowner, and it's passed down generations, and there's still some animosity there. Oh, we didn't like how you dealt with us back in the 50s, you know. And so, oh my, we still have to deal with that sometimes, and I get it. And I don't even know what the history was with that particular issue. And I think sometimes, you know, we'll pull out paperwork, and not all the paperwork we pulled out from the 50s was detailed like it is today how we do things. So you're kind of making assumptions, and so I'm working with landowners today on, you know, on things we have to deal with in right away and stuff. But it's a unique story because it was done so quickly, so fast. Never comes without a little controversy and struggle, but I do have to give it to the folks who were able to get it done, because it's one of the fastest projects and so unique to get it done so quick and such a large project as well.
You know, doing it that fast, and of course, you couldn't have done a traffic survey, if you will, because there was no route like that was available, so you wouldn't know how many cars were on it, and then how to build it, how much base, how wide of lanes, and that sort of thing. Did the original design of the highway stand up to the amount of traffic that you had?
You know, I'm glad you're asking that question, because one of the unique things about, we've got an older roadway. We have an aggressive ongoing maintenance program to keep it nice. But the reason why it's lasted the way it has, we haven't had to completely reconstruct it at times, because they did have some really good foresight. So they built a really, really, really heavy base of rock, but they didn't put that much asphalt. And so quickly, within a few years of the turnpike, that asphalt wore out, and the turnpike had to go back and then add asphalt on it. But the base was so thick and strong, built even to the higher standards of today, we've had a really strong base. And so, yes, they had it. They did it so quickly, and they learned within a few years that they needed, I think they moved to like around 4 inches of asphalt. Now, obviously, we're much thicker and to today's standards, and they had to go back and realize that that was going to be the case. But that big, heavy 36 inches worth of strong aggregate has been still steady today, which has made such a huge asset to our system today. So I do have to appreciate those engineers back in the back there that in the 50s to understood that issue. But yeah, listen, design standards are different today compared to, and technology is better today than back then, but they did a great job. But yeah, listen, when you do a project that fast, I think they were trying to roll it out. They didn't know the load they were going to see, and it was light. It was very light at first. When I talk about what you built it for, around $105 million, but they actually took a larger bond to help with some operations just to get through the first few years, because you're, like you said, they didn't. Today we do traffic studies to understand the traffic patterns and studies and where things are, the trends, and how many folks are going to be traveling. And they didn't have that history. They didn't have that data. So they were guessing a little bit, trying to hope that people would see this as an asset and go, hey, I want to get to Wichita, to Kansas City or Topeka faster, so I'm going to use this turnpike. And some did, some didn't. Some were against it. Some didn't want to pay a premium. Over time, that grew and became a more regular path of travel for Kansans. But you're right. And they had, but listen, and then that puts more wear and tear on your infrastructure. So, but they made adjustments, and over the years we've always made adjustments. But I think it's unique that it's, you learn a little bit at the beginning. That history is kind of fun to go back and see. Didn't have enough asphalt there at the beginning, but they quickly added that more layers of asphalt, and now we're able to maintain that today. But that thick, strong, heavy aggregate base is still there today, which has made our really good infrastructure for over 65 years now.
That is Steve Hewitt. He's CEO of the Kansas Turnpike Authority, a native of Pratt, Kansas, or Greensburg, Kansas. Join us more after the break when we talk about the Kansas Turnpike in the present and the future. Welcome back to On the Front Porch, visiting with Steve Hewitt today. He's CEO of the Kansas Turnpike Authority. The Kansas Turnpike started clear back in the 50s and is doing great clear through today. Steve, give me some idea how many people use the turnpike annually or daily, or is it seasonal?
Well, it is seasonal. I mean, people, it's, you know, you have the travel season. Obviously, the, you know, summer months, we see much more traffic. But so, but this last, this year currently, we think we're going to finish around probably over 37 to 38 million travelers are going to drive on the Kansas Turnpike. Last year, we finished just under 37 million. We've kind of been recovering from the pandemic, obviously, when people didn't travel. So there's, and, you know, we've had, you know, a couple of years in 19 and 18 and 17, close to that 40 million travelers a year. So, but we think we're getting back to that level. And that, yes, you're correct, though. I mean, so the summer months, we'll see big, you know, travel, you know, which will be, you know, over, you know, 3+ million those months, each month. And then, you know, obviously we're at January and February where people aren't traveling quite as much. It'll be less, obviously. But holidays, we monitor holidays. We understand Christmas and Thanksgiving, spring break. Those are big travel, you know, times. So we monitor, we staff correctly, we make sure we are prepared for whatever's out there. We have safety assists. We have folks on the roadway to help those travelers. But so, but yeah, it's more than people realize. And those tolls are what's keeping the system up and running and covering all the costs and everything to maintain this system.
You know, I'll have to give you a plug. I don't know what year it was, but we came back from the Cotton Bowl in Dallas, and it was, everybody had to be back to work the next morning. And I thought as we were coming into Kansas, oh my gosh, the line at the toll booth is going to be awful, because it was like 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning. And you had everything open, and you had extra guys standing out taking tolls, and it was just amazing how you had adjusted. So you do pay attention to that stuff.
We absolutely do. I mean, we take that data. We've got so much data and traffic information and historical trends, knowing when times we see heavy cars, heavy trucks, heavy, you know, in different locations. We understand at a KU football game versus a Chiefs game versus a concert. I mean, those are all things we monitor. We understand the projects and different things that are out there and that can affect our traffic. So if a state highway has an issue and they want to look at us to bypass, are we prepared for, you know, that kind of thing and vice versa? So it's something we do. We monitor, we prepare, and we look at daily. So we can plan projects, plan traffic, plan staff, and we try to understand those kind of that data so we do the right thing for our customers.
So you built the entire turnpike for $105 million. What's your annual budget now?
Well, that's funny you say that, because our annual budget, we'll bring in about $150 million this year in revenue, and our operations are going to be just shy of $70 million, but we put a lot of money back in projects. So our preservation and capital projects will be, you know, close to $60 million as well, if not more. And then we still have a little bit of debt. We have about $85 million in debt, so we have our debt payments to pay. But all that revenue covers all those things to make sure that we cover all those projects and operations it takes to run the thing. So, you know, it's a business. I mean, if people were curious, like, what kind of, I mentioned it out of the city earlier, but it's a lot like a utility, right? So, you know, the how many water gallons you're using, how many units of electricity are you, you know, kilowatts are you using? And so that's really how we base things, understand the usage of the traffic trends. We base traffic trends based on what revenue we think we'll bring in, based on the revenue, and then that revenue is put into what kind of projects can we do, how do we operate those things, you know, how do we replace our equipment, it's time to replace it, we have an aggressive ongoing pavement plan, so we make sure that, you know, so many miles of pavement every year we're going to overlay and prep it up and make sure it lasts another, you know, 7 years. So we're all ongoing working through all these things based on that revenue and those projections of traffic.
And still to this day, you get no federal or state tax dollars.
We don't. We don't take any federal dollars. I take no state dollars. I'm living and dying only by the money we bring in. In fact, you know, even the highway patrol, I have my own troop that's dedicated. Troop G is dedicated. There's 44 troopers that monitor the Kansas Turnpike, and I pay 100% of them. So through an agreement through the Kansas Highway Patrol, I pay for uniforms. I give them their cars. I pay for their salaries. I pay for their health insurance. I take care of all that for them. We take care of everything. We're self-sustaining. We don't want to put any burden on the local taxpayer. But I will say this, though. But people may think, oh, my gosh, but what Kansans are paying for that, and, you know, and we talk about the history. People say, oh, that should have been paid off back, you know, many, many years ago. Well, that's one of those wise tales, too, that, you know, we're always going to have bonds. Like, we're going to have to go get some money here in a couple years for a big project improvement on some ramps on our K-10 connection by Lawrence. We're always going to have project. We're always going to have some bonding. We're always going to have that. And we're self-sustaining, and it would be a burden to the state if we went back to the state. And people just don't realize that, you know, it's if we went back and we tried to go backwards and went to the state or took those federal dollars or state dollars, that, I think that's where you're, people feel double taxation or kind of thing. And but yet we're producing revenue, and half our traffic, excuse me, well, where I was going with this is really when Kansas think, well, it's Kansas are paying for that. Well, half of our traffic comes from out of state. Hmm. So we have out-of-staters that are really funding the Kansas Turnpike, half of it. I mean, I think that, because, listen, Kansas is a through state. Yeah, people come up here to some vacations and, you know, for hunting and fishing, different things, and Kansas obviously have to get around, but a lot of people just have to drive through us, and we understand that. That's just part of rural America. Half of the traffic is coming from out of state. That means half the revenue is really being covered by out-of-staters. I think that's helpful. And if you put it back on the state, then all the state would have to pay for this road. And I think that's what's unique about the system. And we try to keep it affordable so people understand we're not trying to gouge you. But being self-sustaining, we don't have to put a burden on the state but trying to maintain this road. We keep everything in-house, and a lot of that money comes from out-of-state that's helping fund it.
So you're, I guess I'll call them service areas where you can get gas and food. There's two or three or four of them. How do those work? How do you operate those?
That's a great question, because people will say, because we recently have changed some restaurants, and people are like, well, why did you get rid of McDonald's? I mean, come on. We like McDonald's better than we like Dairy Queen, and it's not our choice. How it works, and it's actually set up by statute, we are required to bid those, and they have a contract, and when the contract's up, we bid it out, and we take proposals, and the best bid comes, and so you have to be a credible company and meet our criteria, but it has to be a bid process, and so periodically you'll see a restaurant change, and you know, or a service area, gas station name change. Well, it's not because we like one company over another. Like, I love Blizzards and I love, you know, Quarter Pounders, but I don't choose who goes where. We use that on a bid process. So we bid those out, and we have a Belle Plaine, or a southern location. We have Towanda close to El Dorado. We have in the Flint Hills, we have Matfield Green. We have Emporia, and then we go into Topeka, just on the east side of Topeka, and then we have Lawrence. And so each one of those has fuel, restrooms, and a food option, and we make sure that they meet the criteria of providing food, keeping fuel 24/7, keeping it clean, keeping it nice. We hold them accountable, but we do all through bid. Now, of that $150 million I'm going to bring in this year, I only get about $4 million from that, and those are they have a guaranteed rent they have to pay, and then we get a percentage of their sales. So I'm not making a ton of money, but every little bit helps. It keeps the tolls low. If we can make a little bit of money there to help keep the tolls low, we do that.
You know, the design of interstate highway system and the turnpike appears to be for a lot of safety reasons. I mean, certainly the turnpike, you don't have many access points, so you don't have traffic coming in or out. Is the turnpike statistically a safer place to drive than interstate, or the same or worse? Is there any data on that?
There's data on that. And so here's, you know, any closed road is going to be safer than an open road. So our barrier wall creates a tremendous amount of safety. And to the folks back in the 80s who, late 80s, who said, hey, listen, we need to put a wall, because we should not have a wall. We should have that a grass medium between the two roads, north and south or east and west. And so when you have that potential crossover, you're going to have potential severe accidents when you can cross over. The wall helps a lot. So the wall makes a closed roadway, creates a safer roadway. And so, yes. But with any roadway, I mean, obviously there's going to be accidents, and behavior of customers and drivers has changed over the years with texting and distractions. But overall, the Kansas Turnpike is one of the safest locations you can be on because of that wall, and you're in a closed system. Periodically you'll have crazy people that may go the wrong way, but that happens on regular roads. But you know, but statistically, we are safer by far than most average highways.
That is Steve Hewitt. He's the CEO of the Kansas Turnpike Authority. When we come back, we'll talk about their new tolling, how it's going to work. So join us for the fourth segment of On the Front Porch. Welcome back to the fourth segment of On the Front Porch. My guest today is Steve Hewitt. He's the CEO of the Kansas Turnpike Authority. We're going to talk about tolling and how you collected it over the years. And I got to tell you, Steve, I'm the perfect one to explain all this to, because I'm still that guy that stops and gets tickets. And I guess I'm embarrassed about that. That's soon going to change, it sounds like. But how has tolling changed over the years, both monies you charge and how you collect it?
Yeah, so, you know, the traditional get a ticket when you get off, you know, from a toll booth, and then go to the next exit you want to get off and hand that toll ticket to a toll collector and pay your money. We still do that. Obviously, we have evolved over the years. So back in the 90s, the first evolution away from tickets was the K-Tag. So the K-Tag would offer a lane that if you got a transponder, a little box in your car, we can read that, and we read you when you got on. You had to go a special lane to get on, and then a special lane to get off, and we'd read it, and you wouldn't have to stop. And there'd be a little gate there, and the gate would pop up. You'd have to go slower, but you wouldn't have to stop. And then we'd have a credit card, and we would just or you prepaid, and we'd keep that loaded up, and it would be a simpler way for you not to have to stop and deal with the collector and keep you going. And that was great. I mean, when I showed up, and I've been at the Kansas Turnpike since 2014. I'm wrapping up 10 years now. And 2014, 35% of our customers had a K-Tag. Great. And we then began to, hey, you know, other states have tags. Can my tag work there? Can it work here? Can it work in a different state? And, you know, in late 2014, we connected with Oklahoma and Texas and began to use our tags. Could work in Oklahoma Pike Pass lanes and could work in those Texas locations. And so that was nice. And so then you have that. So all of a sudden, then we changed the formula to say, hey, you know, we had to get a prepayment. You had to preload it, put money on it, and you had to pay for that tag. Well, and then we started getting these little sticker tags. They were cheaper. And we said, you know what? We did some customer surveys. And we said, hey, why do you not have a K-Tag? And I'll go back a minute. So K-Tag is a cheaper way of tolling. Our cost to toll you, our cost to collect, is a fraction compared to I have someone in the toll booth that has to stand there, and you know, we pay an hourly wage, and they collect the toll, and we have a toll booth that has air conditioning and heating and all these things and technology right there. So it's more expensive. So we offer a discount for a K-Tag, and you know, we know who you are, we've got your money, and we'll save you some money. Well, we're like, why don't people want to save more money? And so they said, well, number one, we have to preload it and do all these things. And we said, well, if we give the tag to you for free, don't charge you anything, we'll just tie it to your bank account that way. Instead, you have to prepay everything. We'll just charge you when you use it. And all of a sudden, that became more popular. And we started adding those states like Oklahoma and Texas. More people said, that's great. Well, that's evolved over the last 10 years. So as of right now, instead, 35% of our folks had K-Tags in 2014. Well, today, in 2024, 70% of our customers have a K-Tag. And so we looked internally. We had to put some technology into our booths. We had to either upgrade to how we do that and put quite a bit of, and then that's expensive. And then we did a bunch of customer surveys asking, hey, You like the new way we do KTAG. You're growing in that area. Would you like the way things, you know, what other things you like, and do you like how other states do it? And we kept getting feedback, hey, this movement of not having to stop, we like other states do it. Colorado, Oklahoma, parts of Oklahoma, Texas, everybody's doing this. Way back east, they do it. So we want that. And so we kept getting more feedback. So, in fact, almost 85% of our customers said, yes, we want to have a cashless system. We like that. So, whoa, that was an eye-opener to us. So we had aging equipment. We needed to invest in equipment. We had an aging workforce. We knew that if we did this plan, and we started 5 years ago deciding if we wanted to do it or not, that our collectors, 75% of our collectors would be at retirement age. And then the other 25%, we could put them into other jobs, like we have increased our customer service jobs, like on the phone or reading tags and on cameras. Excuse me. So we just said, you know what? We also know we can be more efficient. We're much more efficient how we operate if we go to this cashless system versus in the lane equipment. That way we can keep tolls low. So as tolls have increased over the years, and we only increase tolls periodically based on our need. We don't have an annual increase. We always want to keep low tolls. And so we can help our customers who want to do this. They want to see this free movement of happening, of travel. We know we need to invest in some infrastructure. Let's invest in the new technology versus the old technology, and we can move our staff around in customer service that's left over, and others will retire. We can do this. And so we just thought it was a really good value. So it's evolved from just KTAG and the ticket to where it's going today. Now, where's it going today? How's it going to work? That's the big question. How's that really going to work? If I'm a ticket person. Kyle, you're a ticket person, right?
Yeah.
So you're wondering how the heck is this going to work. But actually, it's going to be as smooth as it can be. Now, number one, I always want to get you a KTAG because I want to save you money. But let's say you don't have a KTAG. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, 50% of our traffic, they come from out of state, and they may not have a ticket. I mean, they may not have a KTAG or a Pike Pass or something compatible with us. So they need to get a ticket. And they're like, oh, my goodness, what? Not to worry. Yeah. I'm going to make it easy on you. You're just going to drive. You're going to see right now these big silver infrastructure gantries that have cameras and readers on them on the main line. You're just going to drive under that. It's going to say you're on cashless tone zone 127 or 50 or whatever you're at. And it's related to the ramp that you once paid at the ramp. Instead, it's on the main line. You're going to drive under that. We're going to take a picture of your license plate. You can obviously, when you get done with your trip, go online and pull your license plate up and pay, or wait for a bill to come in the mail. We'll send you a bill in the mail, and you got 30 days to pay. And so it works just like, you know, hey, I got my electricity. I ran so much this month, and now they sent the kilowatt cost to me, and I'm going to send it to the utility company. You're going to send it to the toll company, you know, for my tolls I drove on. So it's as simple as that. Now, that would be more expensive than having a KTAG. KTAG will save you money, always will. In fact, it'll be a 50% savings if you have a KTAG. But I will say this, although you'll save money, our board, with the new toll rates coming out, it's real simple, is we're still going to have the lowest tolls in the country, and that's still going to be good even for the folks who don't have a KTAG or do have a KTAG. Wait for the bill to come in the mail. It's going to be reasonable. You're going to save a lot more money if you have a KTAG, but it's still going to be reasonable either way. But it's not that difficult. I want people to worry about it and get nervous about it. And you can always call our customer service line. We'll help you figure it out. But it's as simple as waiting for that bill to come in the mail, or you can go online like our driveks.com, which you can manage all your tolls. That's for if you have a KTAG or don't have a KTAG, manage it all right there. But it's as simple as that. And that's really efficient for us to maintain so we can keep low tolls, but it's also safer because people don't have to stop at the booth, keep traffic flowing and moving, and it's really the future of tolling.
So I've been getting those bills in the mail from Colorado and Texas for several years. It's amazing technology. I mean, all of a sudden, one day here comes the bill in the mail and I pay them. Does everybody pay you? What do you do if somebody doesn't send the money back? I mean, you're going to send a collection agency for $6.50?
Well, listen, I mean, we're going to have some folks who don't pay, and you realistically could have, you know, a small amount like that. Now, that I don't know if I would send you know, we have guidelines and business rules for what we send collections. But, yeah, we send that, and then there's late fees. And then if the late fees aren't paid, then, you know, those go to our collection effort. We have third-party folks that help us find those folks. And I'm not worried about cans. I know Kansans, I can find you. I know I can work with you. And I know most will pay. It's the out-of-staters, the few that don't pay. And, yeah, listen, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. The technology and how other states have done it. And, yes, we call that leakage. There's a few that leak through and don't want to pay. And so, yeah, we have tools in the toolbox. We have companies that help us find those folks, get that bill to them. We have different tools to try to, you know, get them to pay, and there'll be a small segment that doesn't pay, but our operation effort, it will be less expensive, more efficient. So, yeah, and there's actually folks today that don't pay. They drive through the K-Tag lane, through our open road tolling lanes, and they don't pay, and we're chasing them down. That happens. But it's for the betterment of the majority, for safer, more reliable, easier way of tolling, and then we will find those small segment. And like today, about 5% of our folks are we call them violations that don't want to pay, and we're chasing them down. And of the 5%, we get 85% to 90% of them to pay. So we have a small segment, you know, 1%, 2%. Maybe that will grow, obviously, as we go to cashless tolling over the years. But nevertheless, I want everybody to be assured we're going after them in ways to get their dollars. And yeah, it may be a small toll at first, but those late fees add up, and those late fees and those costs for us to go get them. So it's going to be a little heftier cost, and we want to encourage them to pay. And now we want also to see, you know, through customer feedback, the different states, learning from other states how it works, that, you know, those affordable sweet spot tolls, people pay. I mean, they come to your state, most people want to pay, but there's that segment that just say, you know, I'm going to try everything I can to cover my tag or not pay or this and that. You're not going to find me. Eh, we're going to do our best to find you because we think it's important to collect the money and make every effort to do that.
That is Steve Hewitt. He's CEO of the Kansas Turnpike Authority. Big changes coming on the tolling with that, or at least there will be a good incentive to do that. And I think, Steve, you've convinced me even I'm going to go from being old ticket guy to the new transponder guy.
Well, listen, I want to make it as easy as possible for you, and I encourage folks to go to drivecase.com. And July 1st, we're going to make this change. So it's coming. It's going to be a better system. Stay tuned for all the information. I mean, we're going to be compatible with Colorado here in June as well. If you're a K-Tag customer, your life's not going to change. It's Kyle, like you, if you're not used to doing the K-Tag, oh, goodness, what's that mean? Listen, I'm going to make it as easy as I can on you. I like you get a K-Tag to save money, but if you don't want to do that and you just enjoy getting a bill in the mail, we'll send you that bill, pay that thing, and we'll keep things moving down the road.
That is Steve Hewitt, CEO of the Kansas Turnpike Authority. You're listening to On the Front Porch.